Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush made a carefully worded but very clear statement against affirmative action yesterday when he announced his administration will file a Supreme Court brief against the University of Michigan and its admission policy. Such programs are impossible to square with our Constitution, said the president. Now, critics charge that Bush's Republican big tent just got a whole lot smaller this hour on Point. The affirmative action battle redux, college, race, politics, and the president. We begin tonight in Ann Arbor, Michigan, epicenter of the debate. Three white students filed suit against the University of Michigan, asserting that they were denied admission to its undergraduate and law school programs on the basis of race. The law school admitted 352 students in 2002. 6% were black. I spoke earlier with Jeffrey Lehman, dean of the University of Michigan Law School. I asked how he reacted to the president's decision.
Unfortunately, the president's staff simply misinformed him about how the law school's admissions process works. We are every bit as opposed to quotas as the president is, but because he was given an inaccurate description of what we do, his statement did not address the core issue that will ultimately be considered by the Supreme Court.
And that is?
The core issue is whether the Supreme Court should overturn Bakke, a 25-year-old precedent that reflects a pragmatic accommodation between two ideals that we all cherish. We all appreciate the importance of studying in a racially integrated environment, and we all value the abstract ideal of colorblindness. In 21st century America, we cannot yet have meaningful integration under a colorblind system, and that is why Bakke authorized the pragmatic compromise that we now accept as affirmative action.
The president said that he strongly supports diversity of all kinds, including racial diversity in higher education, and yet he opposes the kind of affirmative action steps taken at the University of Michigan. Can any American leader have it both ways?
No, it's not possible. We all would like to have it both ways. It is uncomfortable for us to say that our values, our ideals, are in tension. We all would like to find a magic bullet that would give us an integrated society without paying any attention to race. Of course, if it were possible for us to have a racially integrated campus without paying any attention to race, we would do that. It's not that we have any particular interest in being sued. The reason why we use affirmative action and why we use the cautious form of affirmative action that we use at our law school is because we have to.
Dean Lehman, exactly how does race factor into the admissions process at the University of Michigan Law School?
Well, everyone who applies to the University of Michigan Law School submits a very long application and a very complete file. They're required to take an examination called the LSAT, and our admissions office assembles a big dossier that includes the application, letters of recommendation, essays, undergraduate transcripts, and then our Dean of Admissions reads every piece of paper in every file and makes a judgment about whether the person is appropriate for admission to the law school. And that involves a complex assessment of many different factors. We need to make sure that the person has the intelligence, the analytical ability, the work ethic to thrive in a very competitive classroom. And we also want to know what they will contribute to the classroom, because law school is a very interactive process and students learn a lot from each other. And we're also interested then what the person will contribute to society after they go out and leave. The consideration of racial diversity comes in somewhat late in the day, in the sense that we are only interested in admitting students who we know are going to be able to thrive academically at the law school. And that's true for students of all races. It's when we are considering within that subgroup, it's only when we are considering what each individual student will bring to the class that the benefits of racial diversity factor in. And they're considered because every student benefits from studying in a racially integrated classroom.
Dean Lehman, we talked about President Bush dealing with the tensions inherent in the goals of our society. In all candor, I hear you struggling with that same tension in your description there. It's a complex assessment process, but isn't there a clear moment at which race is considered?
No, that's part of why I struggle with this, because this is not something that's sort of tacked on at the end of the process. It's not something that where there's a moment when we say, let's admit a student of a particular race.
But you don't shy away from saying we use affirmative action. That addresses issues of race.
Yes, I don't, because race continues to be very important in American society, frankly much more important than most of us would like it to be. But our job as an educational institution is to prepare our students to be effective in the world as it is. And that means we need to accept the reality of race and take it into account in our admissions process.
What level of diversity have your procedures led you to achieve?
Well, the percentage of students in the entering class who are African American varies dramatically from year to year. Over the past 5 years, the percentage was 7%, 9%, 10%, 7%, 6% this past year. Everything depends upon who applies in a given year, how they fare in competition with one another in the admissions process. Some years the class is more racially diverse, and some years it's less racially diverse.
If you are not able to apply affirmative action along the lines that you have, how do you foresee the impact on the law school at the University of Michigan and on society more broadly if this becomes the way of the land?
I think it would be a tragic setback for our ability to prepare students to live in a racially integrated society, to be effective in the courtrooms and the boardrooms of America today. One needs to know how to interact effectively with people who are different from oneself, different in every way, including different in race. And so if we were to be put back into a situation where there were only token members of some minority groups in our classes, our students would suffer. They would not be as well prepared as they are today, and all society would suffer.
Dean Lehman, in your case, the Supreme Court is set in part to decide whether there is a compelling state interest in a diverse student body. Do you think there is a compelling state interest in this? And if there is, what does it mean that George Bush is opposing it?
Well, I think it's interesting that the president did not reject the notion that there is a compelling interest in diversity. In fact, there were moments in his statement when I thought he was agreeing with us. He talked about how important it is for students to have this experience of studying with people who have different backgrounds from their own. That is, of course, the essence of what makes this such a compelling educational interest. Yes, it is a compelling educational interest, no question about it. That is the fundamental premise of the Bakke decision that has been a source of stability for all of higher education for 25 years.
Do you look forward to a day when we can have that diversity without affirmative action? Are we headed toward that, or is this a permanent feature of the American landscape?
We have made tremendous progress over the last 25 years. I do look forward to the day when we are able to have meaningful levels of integration without taking race into account. All of us would prefer that we were that way. We're not there yet. We are making progress towards that goal. I think the cautious form of affirmative action that we have been using is the right way to continue making progress towards that goal. I fear that a sudden reversal, a destabilizing reversal of Bakke, an insistence on a rigid form of colorblindness would in fact set us back in our progress towards that goal.
Dean Lehman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Lehman is Dean of the University of Michigan Law School. He spoke with us earlier from Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're talking tonight about college, race, politics, and the president's decision to file a Supreme Court brief against affirmative action. Can President Bush support diversity and oppose affirmative action? Is it possible to have it both ways? Who benefits from racially aware admissions policies? Minorities? The entire nation? And what about systems that take not only race into account, but also geography, athletics, alumni, parents? Just how level should the playing field be? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He's written extensively about the college admissions process in America and watches all things American. Good evening and welcome, James Fallows.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me a call.
It's great having you back, James. James, there's a lot to talk about here. The process that goes into college admissions and affirmative action today, the politics of the president's announcement yesterday. Let's look at the politics first. What do you make of his move, its timing, its implications for the Republican Party, for the country post-Trent Lott, pre-2004 election?
Well, you know, the politics, from a historical perspective, the politics are probably the less important aspect of this, but they are fascinating at the moment because one strong stream of Republican Party rhetoric over the last 3 or 4 years, which culminated in the nomination of Mr. Bush a couple of years ago, was that to broaden its base beyond the sort of southern white male core that had been so important over the last 25 years, the Republicans needed to be what George Bush was during his campaign, that is an embracing, inclusive, compassionate conservative. There are demographic trends in the South and West which mean that the white base, which has been sufficient to the Republicans, might not be that in the long run.
And President Bush knows that very well.
Oh, certainly knows it better than you or me or anybody else, and Karl Rove even better than he does.
Down to the decimal point and beyond.
And so the question is why in the aftermath of Trent Lott, et cetera, this signal would be sent when it wasn't necessary? And I guess, you know, from outside the black box, one has to think that they thought either that as a matter of legal principle it was so compelling, or that as a matter of a signal to the so-called base it had to be sent. But that is a fascinating story of what exactly they had in mind sending the signal after the Trent Lott case.
We're going to keep those politics in mind throughout the hour tonight. James Fallows, you know the processes that universities use today very well. Give us a very clear sense, if you can, of how affirmative action is working today, to the extent you know how the University of Michigan is applying it. Dean Lehman was very forthcoming in it. There's always just a little bit of obscura around the final detail here. How important is race in affirmative action in the processes that many, most colleges use today?
I think what makes this question so fascinating when it comes to colleges, as opposed to almost any other arena of American life, as opposed to job discrimination or promotion in the military or, you know, appointment to executive offices or whatever you might name, is that colleges, by very conscious definition over the last large number of decades, have tried to take into account a whole range of factors in putting together their classes. When you talk to college admissions officers, as I've done for various Atlantic stories in the last few years, they stress how much an art rather than a science this is. They say, yes, we need to have the people with the 1600s on the SATs, but we need a quarterback for the football team, and we need an oboist, and we need people who have school spirit, and we need people who are from Wyoming, and we need all these sorts of things. And since their guiding principle is a whole range of things other than strict numerical merit, it is natural that race for this country is a very important part of what they have in mind. And so it's harder to say that it's illegitimate to take into account that very, very important part of American identity when so many other things, from fueling a hockey team to winning the math competition, also go into that subjective decision.
We're not arguing that at this moment, but what's the relative weight of race compared to oboe virtuosity?
It's impossible to say. I mean, and let me explain what I mean by that. For an individual oboe player, you know, being good on the oboe, or being a great hockey goalie, or being a great, you know, Division I athlete,
or from Wyoming, as you say,
from Wyoming, you know, it's very difficult to say in the abstract how those things match up. What you can say, however, is if you were looking at the relatively distorting effects, the things that seemed you know, kind of disproportionate in college admissions, race is not where you would start. Overwhelmingly, you'd start with so-called legacy effects, the role of being the child of one or two alumni parents. That is, by sort of every objective measure, more important than the racial advantage when it comes to getting into college.
I read this week that Harvard accepts 40% of legacy applicants compared with 11% overall acceptance rate. That's an incredible ratio.
It is. And there is a sort of rationalization or answer that the Harvard admissions office would give you, which is that there's a sort of self-selection among their alumni children applicants, and they have other advantages, blah, 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 and they are higher scoring on average, too, before they come in, but still, it's undoubtedly a plus for them, and so is the case. It was almost as great a disparity at Notre Dame, where
almost, you know, a quarter of the, I think, the incoming class was sons and daughters of alums.
Right, and there, then of course there's the so-called development interest skew. at any university, and this is something that no one likes to admit, but they have to. There's a certain proportion of the student body let in simply because they or their parents either have given or will give money.
Money, the big word. James Fallow, stand by. We have to take a short break. It looks like there's all kinds of affirmative action here. We're talking about race tonight. Has affirmative action worked for the country? The president said he is for diversity and against affirmative action. Can he have it both ways? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about affirmative action in college admissions and President Bush's vote against. He's saying no and asking the Supreme Court to rule against University of Michigan procedures that are reflective of procedures in many colleges around the country. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Has affirmative action worked for the country? Would our campuses represent our American racial diversity without affirmative action? Might they? Is admissions attention to race more troubling to you than attention to geography, to athletics, to alumni parents? And is the president right or wrong? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is James Fallow. He's national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. And we're joined now from Reston, Virginia, by Linda Chavez. She's president of the Center for Equal Opportunity, a Washington think tank that works to end racial preferences. She's former staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights under President Reagan from 1983 to 1985. Good evening and welcome, Linda Chavez.
It's good to be with you.
Linda Chavez, give us your top line. What do you think about the president's position? Is he on the right track? Is he pushing the right way in pushing against affirmative action?
I think he's on the right track. I'm not yet ready to give him my unqualified support with respect to the actual brief that has been filed. My understanding is it will not go nearly far enough and will not, in fact, argue the main point of this decision, of this case, which is whether or not race can be taken into account as one factor among several.
So what do you like about his position, and what more do you want him or someone
to
go for?
Well, I want him to close the door once and for all on using race as a factor in college admissions decisions. I disagree wholeheartedly with what Mr. Fallows has said. I read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution as it is written in plain English to say that there shall be equal protection of the laws without regard to the color of one's skin. And I do not believe that a university that is state-run can pick who gets into school using race as a factor. And by the way, Mr. Fallows earlier said that he suggested it was really only a minor factor and that it in no way equaled the kind of preference given, for example, to alumni students. Remember, we are only talking about public colleges and universities in this case. What Harvard does is irrelevant. It is not governed by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. My organization, the Center for Equal Opportunity, has studied admissions data for 57 public colleges and universities, and what we have found is that race is not a minor factor. It is an overwhelming factor. At the University of Michigan and at Ann Arbor, the odds ratio admission for a black student with identical grades and test scores to a white student were 174-1 in favor of that student being admitted. And in fact, the point differences in terms of SATs were dramatic. They were 230 points on average lower. Black students were than whites, and they had a half a point grade point average lower among their high school scores.
We'll come back to that with Jim Fallows, but let me put it to you then on two planes. First is, and you're addressing this, you're saying in strict constitutional terms, this is simply illegal. This is unconstitutional.
It's unconstitutional. And by the way, it's because race is toxic. Race is different than anything else.
We'll address that. Address the cultural side of this, Linda Chavez. If affirmative action goes away, if the Supreme Court rules, as President Bush hopes they will, as he's urging them to, what would the consequences be on campuses and for the country?
Well, we've seen what the consequences will be at those places like the University of California, where they've gotten rid of race as a factor in admission. And what we've seen is that, yes, the numbers have dropped at some of the most competitive schools in the state system. At Berkeley and at UCLA, the numbers have dropped. But overall, system-wide, the numbers have actually increased. There are more black and Hispanic students students going to the University of California system under race-blind admissions than there were back in the old days of race preferences. And what's more, and what is more important with respect to the chances of these individual students, is that they have higher graduation rates. They are more likely, because they are actually attending universities where their grades and test scores allow them to compete on an equal footing, they have a much better chance of staying in school and graduating, and therefore being able to enter, get a firm foothold in the middle class, and be able to do well.
We spoke earlier, Linda Chavez, with the dean of the University of Michigan Law School. He described, as many university administrators do, the value of a diverse campus in and of itself for all students of all races. Are you discounting that? If you're saying that the higher-end colleges, public schools, would be less diverse, are you saying it doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter whether Linda Chavez's son goes to the University of Michigan Law School or James Fallows's daughter goes to the University of Michigan Law School. The fact is that most of the students who, in fact, benefit from these preferences are upper-middle class. They are not disadvantaged, and simply having a different color skin or simply having a different ethnic background does not, in fact, demonstrate diversity. And frankly, it would be much better if some kid from West Virginia, whose both parents were white, but who came from a working class background, that would add more diversity to the school than some upper middle class black or Hispanic getting in based on racial preferences.
Linda Chavez, James Fallows, a lot of callers want to join our conversation. Let's turn to them. Anthony's calling from DeLand, Florida. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Today, I heard Mr. Bush on the radio talking about his opposition to affirmative action.
Yes.
And he went into some detail as to why he was opposed to it.
And was it persuasive to you, Anthony?
Well, it was interesting, you know, listening to a guy who went to, I believe, Phillips Andover, by all accounts didn't do very well there, but still got into Yale. By all accounts, it was a middling student there, but then still got into the Harvard Business School. You did touch on what private schools like Harvard and Yale do, but what I wonder, and I'm actually amazed by, you know, how much of an advantage legacy still
it is pretty amazing, isn't it?
Can I interrupt here, though, because this is
sure, come
important.
In, Linda.
Okay, because we keep hearing this, this is
maybe
a card,
I could
and I want to put it to rest once and for all.
Yeah, sure.
We studied the issue of legacies at the University of Virginia. We were told by the dean there that legacies actually were a bigger factor than race. We actually went in and studied it, and what we found was that they were not nearly as large a factor, that race, in fact, trumped all other factors.
Including private schools, Linda Chavez?
Well, we looked only at the University of Virginia because that was the only school that, in fact, gave us that data. But what I'm suggesting is that I don't believe that that legacies at public colleges are as large a factor. And, in fact, I don't know how you could ever...
We're not talking about public colleges.
Well, I
want to get Anthony's question here. We'll all contemplate George W. Bush at Yale for a moment while Anthony comes in.
Well,
is it okay if I talk?
Anthony, please. Caller, Linda, let's please let our caller give his question.
Thank you. I mean, that's what I wonder if I could get in before...
just give us your question, Anthony. What do you got?
What I wonder is, what is the situation with legacies at public universities like the University of Michigan?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for your call, Anthony. And Linda Chavez, I think we've got your view that it's not nearly as big a factor as is often suggested.
You can actually go on to our website, ceousa.org, and you can read the study, and you can see what the logistic regression actually demonstrates. You can look at our study at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and at the University of Virginia, where we did, in fact, test the question of whether or not legacy played an important role, and in fact, it did not.
James Fallows, what do you make of this this debated field?
I know less about the legacy situation at public universities than I do at private universities, where no one can seriously contest the idea. It's a very important factor at private universities. Even at public universities, however, the admissions office takes into account a wide range of factors in deciding the mix that is appropriate to its student body. They give athletes preference over certain other people. They do give musicians preference. Each department has its own number of people. They want to have a certain flow of historians. They want to have a certain flow of people in different mathematics departments. So the idea that this is a seamlessly, you know, logical and mathematical process, even at public universities, I think overstates the way that it should work. And so if all these other factors are legitimate for even public universities to consider, but only race is not legitimate. That seems to me a strange way to view it.
There's a very simple reason why, James.
Linda Chuffis.
Race is not allowed to be considered is that we have a history in this country of race being used very perniciously by government to discriminate against people.
Right.
We had hundreds of years of that kind of discrimination.
But isn't that the whole point, Linda Chavez, to try and do some rectification here,
well,
in part?
Well, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't believe that because you've discriminated against one group because of the color of their skin, that it is therefore permissible to discriminate against a different group now. And by the way, let's remember, it's not just white students who are being rejected. It's Asian American students, it's Jewish students, it's Arab American students. And in two of the prominent universities that we studied in our studies, we found Hispanics were also disadvantaged by ethnicity. At the University of Virginia and at the University of North Carolina, we found that those schools, in fact, discriminated against Hispanics. And in fact, you needed to have higher grades and test scores if you were Hispanic in order to get in.
Linda Chavez, James Fallows, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation Lee Bollinger. He's former president of the University of Michigan, now president of Columbia University. So he's served both on the public and private side here. Good evening and welcome, Lee Bollinger. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Lee Bollinger, Linda Chavez is making a strong case against affirmative action. She's outspoken about it around the country. You've no doubt heard the case she makes. James Fallows is saying there are many factors that come into play here. What's your view? You were at the University of Michigan when these practices were playing out. In fact, I guess when the suits were brought, what do you make of the president's opposition and the general question of whether it's right to continue with affirmative action?
Right. Well, those are several questions. I was president when the suits were filed, and was the one who said that we should really build a legal defense and take it to the public and to try to explain it. So my view is that this is incredibly important and the most important civil rights case, I think, in a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think I begin by saying that this is all of higher education supports this. That's the AAU, the 61, 62 research universities. Many, many major business corporations led by General Motors, President Gerald Ford, unions. I mean, the mainstream America and higher education believe that this is very important.
The Why?
Supreme Court held this to be constitutional. Mm-hmm. That arises out of Brown versus Board of Education. And it's important for the reason given in Bakke, the case that said that it was constitutional, and that's simply that in order to prepare students for the modern world, which is highly, highly diverse and getting more so, it's very important to educate our students in a diverse environment. And the fact of the matter is, as was pointed out just a moment ago by one of your speakers, race still does matter a great deal in American society, and we have a great deal of segregated communities. The overwhelming majority of students at the University of Michigan come from either all-white or all-black high schools. So the first time they encounter an integrated world is when they arrive as freshmen at the university. This is really something that we've worked on as a society for 50 years, and I think we've made progress. It would be a great pity, really a tragedy, I think, if we were forced at this point to abandon it.
How would you describe the consequences if indeed the Supreme Court rules against?
Well, I think what we have found is that there is no viable alternative to really very conscious consideration of race as simply a factor.
Linda Chavez says California works without it.
It doesn't because there are two, she's referring to the percent solutions, as they're called. There are two types of percent solutions, and the one in California is your if you graduate from the top 4% in any high school in the state, you're guaranteed admission in one of the UC system colleges or universities. And that leaves Berkeley and UCLA, the flagship universities, with greatly diminished diversity. The other type of percent solution is that in Texas, which was implemented under President Bush when he was governor. And that does give you guaranteed access to the flagship university, the University of Texas. So they take the top 10% of every high school in the state. The problem with that solution is that it doesn't do anything for diversity in graduate schools, law schools, medical schools,
and all the rest. Lee Bollinger, if you'd stand by, we have a Michigan caller on the line. Edward's calling from Boston. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good evening. Fine, thanks.
I just had a couple things. First of all, I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan, both as an undergraduate in the law school, and I love my university. But I do have some concerns about the impact of this policy. I know
you've got the former president on the line. What's your concern?
Well, I know at my time at the law school that there was a great deal of concern about some of the minority students.
Why?
Who had been admitted because they were getting special treatment that other people weren't getting.
What kind?
Special review classes that other students weren't invited to. And this really created a lot of resentment within the class, which was antithetical to the idea that if we bring people from different backgrounds together, they will actually meet and progress will come of that. Instead, I think people became much more suspect of the entire process.
So, what conclusion do you draw from that, Edward, that those minority students should not have been there in the first place, that affirmative action made a problem, not a positive step forward?
Well, I think in that particular circumstance it did, and that it's a remedy for a problem that I don't think anyone denies exists, but the problem is, by and large, poor educational opportunities for individuals who come from these minority communities. And it's not a remedy that's directly tailored toward fixing that. It's a very tough problem to fix. And the remedy is to go in and fix that those educational systems.
And fixing them even in law school. Edward, stand by. Lee Bollinger, how about it? Is Edward's complaint credible, legitimate in your mind, or is he just being ignoble wanting to see review classes for minority students there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to begin at a common place, and I think we do. And that is that race has really mattered in American society. There's been great injustice inflicted on African Americans and other groups. This is a history, a legacy that is with us today, will stay with us for some time. An area like metropolitan Detroit is the most segregated area in the United States. It's more segregated today than in 1960. I've already given the statistics about the students coming to the university. So from that, you can draw a number of conclusions. And my conclusion, and that of universities across the country, is bringing people together and trying to overcome these differences and divisions and suspicions and stereotypes and the like is really a critical role for a university.
Lee Bollinger, what about the conservative argument that affirmative action actually perpetuates problems? It's a kind of it shows a kind of disrespect to minorities, and by making these allowances perpetuates a problem.
You know, this is a very odd argument. We give, as another one of your people on the program said,
James Fallows, Linda Chavez, yes.
Yeah, every university gives a plus factor for things other than race, like geographic distribution. So if you have a person who grew up in a rural town in Oregon, as I did, I'm sure I got a plus factor in going to a great law school.
Mm-hmm.
We do that for international students, different socioeconomics parts from this economic spectrum. Nobody asked the question, do people who get in part because they come from rural Oregon, whether they feel stigmatized because they got that plus factor? So there's something else going on here, which I think really is rooted in the just basic problems we have about thinking about race. So I don't blame affirmative action for that view that this stigmatizes African-Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans. I think it really, however, is something that is not something to be taken seriously.
I'm glad that you don't think it's something to be taken seriously, but as the only person on the program who is actually somebody who is eligible for such preferences, I can tell you that I resent mightily that anyone would think that because of my ethnicity, I could not score as well on an LSAT, or I could not do as well in school.
Linda Chavez, we're going to have to hold it right there. We're coming to a break, and Lee Bollinger, I know we have to let you go.
I do.
Lee Bollinger, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Lee Bollinger is president of Columbia University. He was president of the University of Michigan when this litigation began. We're talking tonight about affirmative action in college admissions and President Bush's vote against. Can Bush be a friend of minorities and an enemy of affirmative action? Overall, does America gain or lose by affirmative action? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about affirmative action in college admissions and President Bush's vote against. Is the president right or wrong? Is diversity worth some social engineering or not? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and Linda Chavez, president for the Center for Equal Opportunity, a Washington think tank that works to end racial preferences. Linda Chavez, I had to cut you off, and James, just before the break. We'll get to both of you. I apologize here, but we have a surplus of great minds with us tonight. Linda Chavez, you were saying that you personally feel an affront in the affirmative action leg up.
Well, I think that the caller made a very important point, and that is that despite having 4 years of affirmative action programs at the undergraduate level, students who, by the way, are no longer going to segregated public high schools in Detroit, Michigan, they're ending up at the University of Michigan, and then still needing affirmative action to get into the University of Michigan Law School. And then we find that not only are they given a leg up in admission, but there are special programs set up, and the students still, in fact, drop out in higher numbers, do more poorly in terms of their grades and do not pass the bar at the same rates as students who've gotten in on their own.
But yet, of course, some will. So what's the problem with that exactly?
Well, the problem is that when you have taken race into account in this way, you have the government once again doing what it did in the bad old days of segregation, the bad old days before Brown versus Board of Education, and that is picking winners and losers based on the color of their skin. And it is not, as I said earlier, not just whites who are disadvantaged. It's Hispanics that are disadvantaged by this program. It's Arab Americans who are disadvantaged. It's Jewish students who are disadvantaged, and it's Asians. Asians in very large numbers are disadvantaged.
You're saying losing out to blacks and Latinos, I guess you're suggesting, in the admissions
process. And by the way, you know, the other thing that I find fascinating about these arguments is that Mr. Bollinger seems to suggest that if he had not given preference in admission to the University of Michigan Law School to these black students, that they would have ended up not going to law school at all. And what, again, we showed in
I heard him saying that. They wouldn't have gone to Michigan.
They wouldn't have gone to Michigan, but they would have gone someplace else. And they
or
would
some
have
would not have gone to Michigan,
they
perhaps.
They would have gone someplace else where, in fact, they could compete on an equal footing, where they weren't in special classes, where they weren't having to go to special review sessions, and where, in fact, they could end up on the law journal on their own merit and law review on their own merit.
And maybe be better off. James Fallows, I want to get your capacious mind in here. What do you make of this whole debate? Well, here we are in 2003, and it's all about affirmative action again. What's new? Where are we going here?
Well, over the last 30 or 35 minutes, I've stored up a couple things I wanted to say. So
I bet you have.
Listen, if I could. One is, Ms. Chavez was mentioning before the break that she was taking offense because only she was potentially eligible for these programs, et cetera. And as President Bollinger was saying, that is not true. And let me explain why in my own case. As with Lee Bollinger, I came from a very small town in the American frontier. I grew up in a small town in California, and I know for an absolute fact, because I heard it from the admissions office, that when I went to a fancy East Coast university, a big factor was geographic distribution. I got a plus factor because I was from this little podunk town that didn't send people to fancy universities.
So, and you did nothing to earn that.
It was an accident.
Except grow up there.
Exactly. And it's part of the general mosaic of a whole lot of very, very complicated preferences that go into deciding who goes to college. And outrage only over a racial preference is to me imbalanced. It seems to me, second, it's worth saying that there is a distinction between the president's position and Ms. Chavez's, in which is that he places some emphasis on having he would like to have diverse universities as a goal for their own sake.
Yes.
He disagrees with this means. Finally, it's worth mentioning that even President Bush in Texas supported what was in effect a sort of affirmative action program, saying that the top 10% of each high school could get into the University of Texas. Since many high schools are still de facto segregated, that was a kind of affirmative action plan which he endorsed.
James Fallows, it's great to have you here. We have callers as well. Amin is calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Amin. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm black. I'm a grad from the University of Michigan.
All right.
I don't know if I got in because I'm black or because I'm smart.
Or both.
Hello?
Or both, sir.
Or both. But the thing is, once you get into the U, you have to work hard just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always nice to have someone that's similar just from a parent straight off so that you can have something to connect to. Many a time, I was the only black person in class, and so I'm sitting off to the side a little because I don't know how to approach people. I might not be the most outgoing
What year did you graduate, I mean?
I just graduated in December.
So you're right out of the very scene that we're talking about here tonight. Where do you come down on this? You hear the arguments pro and con. Do you think in the end that affirmative action is important? Would you like to see it set aside and go straight in without it? What's your view?
No, I don't think it should be set aside because a diverse student population is extremely important. It's not so much in the classroom, but when you're out, when you're going to the gym and you're playing ball and you get to interact, and then from there you might go to the same bar, the same club, or see that they're in the same class, and then you start to form bonds outside the classroom that will start to build bridges inside the classroom, and then you start to dispel all these stereotypes. Well, you know, this white guy can't play ball, or this guy's not as intelligent as I think, or he got in on this, or my SATs are better than his, or I'm smarter than him. You start to cut those down immediately, and then it opens your eyes to everybody.
I mean, if you'll stay with us, I'd like to get Linda Chavez to respond, and please stay with us. I want to know how you two size each other up. Linda.
Well, first of all, I'm glad for Amin that he was able to graduate from the University of Michigan. In fact, if you look at minority students who are admitted under preferences, what you find is that in most schools there is a 2 to 3 times greater attrition rate for those students. They don't, in fact, graduate. We looked at 6-year graduation rates at the schools that we studied, and we found much larger attrition rates. But I want to contradict something that you suggested, which is that I don't seem to care about whether or not there are more black and Hispanic students attending top-rate universities.
Well, I thought that's what I heard you say earlier.
No, I care very deeply that more black and Hispanic students attend universities.
So how would you like it to happen?
The only way it's going to happen in any kind of meaningful way is when we close the skills gap that exists for black students who attend inner-city schools that, in fact, do a lousy job of educating them, and the same for Hispanic students.
Well, let me put that to Amin, if I may, Linda Chavez. Amin, Linda Chavez says, let's do away with affirmative action and improve the skills in the elementary schools and high schools. What do you think? Would you have liked to wait for that eventuality?
No, because if we wait for, you know, leave no child behind, then we'll all be left behind. Well, the thing is, I went to public school, and I understand how piss poor public school can be. And so you have to bust your butt, and you got to work hard, and your parents have to be involved to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, where are these teachers coming from? I want my teacher, if it's in a public school, to come from the University of Michigan or to come from a tier one school where it's highly competitive, and they know how to get you there.
Which means they may have to be black.
They might have to be, and if they're black, that also cuts down the bridge then. But if they're white, then, you know, it doesn't really matter also because they know.
I mean, congratulations on that degree, and thank you for calling us. James Fallows, what do you make of this solution, not affirmative action, but fixing education from the ground up that will produce the rainbow on the campus?
Of course. I mean, that's the long-term goal for all of us. I think there is one important sort of social measure worth bearing in mind here, that if you have, you know, the great class line in American society is between people who have a college degree and people who don't. That says everything about your opportunity, your earning power. If parents have a college degree, their children are very, very likely to have a 4-year college degree. This is a way to sort of ratchet people up above the line. And so affirmative action by that light can be a useful way to sort of get people from the lower class American society up to above that divide in a way that tends to have lasting benefits because their children end up being in the college class too.
And Linda Chavez, you're watching closely. How do you think, we've just got 30 seconds left, how do you think the Supreme Court is going to go?
I think the Supreme Court will unquestionably strike down the Michigan plan. I'm hopeful that they will also say that we do think it's important to close the skills gap in America between blacks and whites, but using race and taking race into account in public colleges and universities is not the way to do it.
And James Fallows, 20 seconds, but if they do that, what consequences do you foresee?
I think there'll be another version of civil rights debate of how exactly we close what is an undeniable large gap in our society in achievement and opportunity between other races, among the races.
Well, that debate is raging right here tonight. James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're
terrific. And Linda Chavez, thank you for your vigorous defense of your view. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you.
Linda Chavez is president of the Center for Equal Opportunity, a Washington think tank that works to end racial preferences. She was former staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights under President Reagan from 1983 to 1984. 5. You can continue this affirmative action conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a shunned poet speaks out. This is On Point. Arizona Gray stepped from his quiet life in Hooksett, New Hampshire, and landed in a political fray last fall after submitting a poem called New Hampshire to his state senator. When Senator Ted Gatzis proposed it as the state poem, armchair critics and the Academy came out in force to assail Gray's work as amateur or worse. Gray, construction worker by day and poet in his off hours, recently withdrew the poem from consideration. In this radio diary, Arizona Gray questions what makes a poem legitimate, and affirms his love for his state with a reading of New Hampshire.
The first newspaper that was actually commenting on this, they asked the question to a few well-known poets. Donald Hall was one, the Robert Frost Society was another, and they put their two cents in, saying that it should be from someone that's no less than first rate, which came from Donald Hall, and which is calling me a second-rate poet. And then Robert Frost Society says, who does this guy think he is? Robert, it should be Robert Frost, and I don't know why, because they said themselves that Robert Frost's poem isn't good for New Hampshire because it portrays New Hampshire just like Vermont. Donald Hall wrote a poem called New Hampshire, and he basically said New Hampshire was going to hell, so he wouldn't submit his. I'm the only one that submitted a poem for a state poem in the history of New Hampshire. I guess most of the comments, like from Donald Hall and the Robert Frost Society, were because, from what I gather, most of the poets are academic poets. They go to college and they get a degree, and I never did that. I just feel it, and I write it. And I guess they're either jealous or they can't do it that way. I do not read a lot of poetry. In fact, I'm not really big into reading anything. I read it once, and if I don't understand it, then I got to read it again, because I tend to read faster than what my eyes see. When I write, all kinds of typos in my stuff. I have to have somebody else proofread it for me. I already know what I want to say, and I've already said it, so by the time I read it, I've already thought it, and it's, you know, a lot of typos, a lot of misspells, but I'm, you know, that's, to me, that's petty, the feelings there. The poem, New Hampshire, came to me throughout my whole life. I love going fishing up in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, and some of the places I would see, very rarely do people see. And I said, wow, we have all this, and we're taking this like it's nothing. And I've always enjoyed the different seasons of New Hampshire, what it has to offer besides vacation land. It offers freedom to me. I work in construction, but I also do a lot of craft shows and trade shows. I'm sold in 10 countries now by way of the internet. I've written 365, 67 poems and verses to date. I've gotten calls from Russell Stover's Candy that they wanted to use my words on their boxes, from Hallmark, Barnes & Nobles. I've turned some of them down because I didn't like what they were doing with it. These are my words and my feelings. New Hampshire. If there is a heaven on earth, then it must be in New Hampshire, where mountaintops kiss the heavens and angels rest upon their snowy peaks, where the multicolored sunrise caresses the clear blue ocean waters. The magic of love can be felt here. For you see, true love is made New Hampshire, then sent throughout the heavens for lovers to find. So if you must see the cool, clear waterfalls that flow through walls of granite, or the face of God that is carved into the mountain, and feel the clean, crisp winds that sing out with the breath of angels, and look into your heart, because a little bit of New Hampshire is in each one of us.
Arizona Gray lives in Hooksett, New Hampshire. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org, or mail us your radio diary. That address is On Point, WBUR Boston, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is